Chapter 15. Cromwell's chauffeur drove the 1906 Rolls-Royce Brougham, made by the London coachmaker Barker, with its six-cylinder, 30-horsepower engine, from the garage to the front of the palatial Nob Hill mansion Cromwell had designed himself and constructed from white marble blocks cut and hauled by railroad from a quarry in Colorado. The front end had the appearance of a Greek temple, with high fluted columns, while the rest of the house was more simply designed, with arched windows and a cornice that crowned the walls. While the chauffeur, Abner Weed, a stony-faced Irishman whom Cromwell hired more for his experience as a wrestler than his expertise behind the wheel of an automobile, stood patiently by the rolls out front, Cromwell waited for his sister in his study, sprawled comfortably on a leather sofa, listening to Strauss waltzes on an Edison cylinder phonograph. He was conservatively dressed in a dark wool suit. After listening to Voices of Spring, he changed cylinders and played Tales from the Vienna Wood. The cylinders played 2 minutes of music each. Cromwell glanced up from the machine as his sister came into the room wearing a doe-skin dress that fell around her nicely curved calves. "A bit risque, aren't we?" he said, eyeing her exposed flesh. She spun around, swirling the skirt and showing off her legs up to mid-thigh. "Since we're going slumming on the Barbary Coast, I thought I'd dressed like a soiled dove." "Just be sure you don't act like one." He rose from the sofa, turned off the phonograph, and held up her coat so she could slip into it. Even with his shoe lifts, he stood the same height as his sister. Then he followed her through the large, intricately carved front doors to the drive and the waiting Rolls-Royce. Abner, attired in his liveried uniform with shiny black boots, stood at attention, holding open the rear door. The Rolls was a town car, with an enclosed passenger compartment, the chauffeur in the open air with nothing but the windshield to protect him. As soon as Cromwell's sister was settled, he instructed the driver where to go. Abner shifted gears, and the big car rolled silently over the granite stones laid in the street. "This is the first opportunity we've had to talk since I came home," said Cromwell, secure in the knowledge that the driver could not hear their conversation through the divider window separating the front and rear seats. "I know that your trip to Salt Lake City was successful, and our bank is another $700,000 richer. You haven't told me how you made out in Denver." "Your spies in the Van Dorn agency were quite accurate in their assessment of the investigation. The Denver office has taken on the job of lead investigator in the hunt for the Butcher Bandit." "I hate being called that. I would have preferred something with more swank."
"Like what, pray tell?" she asked, laughing.
"The stylish spirit."
She rolled her eyes. "I doubt that newspaper editors would be enthused with that one."
"What else did you find out?"
"The head of the Denver office, Nicholas Alexander, is an idiot. After I flashed a few of my charms, he couldn't stop speaking about the hunt. He was angry he wasn't put in charge of the investigation and had no reservations about revealing pertinent information concerning the methods they were going to use to catch the notorious bandit. Van Dorn himself named his top agent, Isaac Bell, to the case. A handsome and dashing devil, and very wealthy, I might add."
"You saw him?"
"I met him, and what's more, I danced with him." She pulled a small photograph from her purse. "I was waiting to give you this." Not the greatest likeness, but the photographer I hired was not very proficient at shooting photographs without setting them up in advance. Cromwell switched on the dome light of the car and examined the photo. The photo showed a tall man with blonde hair and mustache.
"Should I be concerned about him?"
Her eyes took on an evasive expression. "I can't say. He seemed more intelligent and sophisticated than our spies led me to believe. I had them check his background. He rarely, if ever, fails to find and apprehend his man. His record is quite admirable. Van Dorn thinks very highly of him. If, as you say, he is affluent, why is he wasting his time as a simple detective? Margaret shrugged. I have no idea. Maybe, like you, he craves a challenge, too. She hesitated as she adjusted an imaginary loose curl with her fingers. Where did he get his money? Did I forget to mention that he comes from a family of bankers in Boston? Cromwell stiffened. I know of the Bells. They own the American States Bank of Boston, one of the largest financial institutions in the country. He's a paradox, she said slowly, recalling her few minutes with him in the Brown Palace Hotel. But he can also be very dangerous. He'll come after us like a fox chasing a rabbit. A detective who knows the inner workings of banking procedures is not good, Cromwell said, his tone low and icy. We must be especially wary. I agree. You're certain he had no clue to your true identity. I covered my tracks well. As far as he and Alexander know, my name is Rose Manteca from Los Angeles, where my father owns a large ranch. If Bell is as smart as you suggest, he'll check that out and prove Rose doesn't exist. So what? She said impishly. He'll never know my name is Margaret Cromwell, sister of a respected banker who lives in a mansion on Nob Hill in San Francisco. What other information did you pry out of Alexander? Only that Bell's investigation is not going well. They have no clues that lead in your direction. Alexander was angry that Bell hadn't taken him into his confidence. He said that Bell was close-mouthed concerning his actions with a pair of agents known as Curtis and Irvine. All I could find out is they're all out beating the bushes in search of a lead. That's good to hear. Cromwell smiled thinly. They'll never consider that a banker is behind the robberies. She gazed at him. You could quit, you know. We no longer need the money. And no matter how careful, no matter how sharp-witted you are, it's only a question of time before you're caught and hung. You want me to give up the excitement and the challenge of achieving what no one else would dare and play the role of a stodgy banker for the rest of my days? No, I do not, she said with a wicked sparkle in her eye. I love the excitement, too. Then her voice softened and became distant. It's just that I know it cannot go on forever. The time will come when we know when to stop, he said without emphasis. Neither brother nor sister possessed even a tinge of repentance or remorse for all the men, women, and children Cromwell had murdered. Nor could they have cared less for all the savings of small businesses, miners, and farmers they had wiped out when the robbed banks, unable to refund their depositors, had to close their doors. "Who are you taking tonight?" she asked, changing the subject. "Marion Morgan." "That prude," she scoffed. "It's a mystery to me why you keep her on the payroll." She happens to be very efficient, he retorted, not seeking an argument. Why haven't you ever taken her to bed? She said with a soft laugh. You know I never play with my employees. It's a principle that has saved me much grief. I'm only taking her out tonight as a bonus for her work, nothing more. His sister's dress was pulled to her knees, and he reached over and squeezed one of them. Who is the lucky man this evening? Eugene Butler. That fop, he taunted. He's as worthless as they come. He's filthy rich. His father is filthy rich, Cromwell corrected her. If Sam Butler hadn't made a lucky strike when he stumbled onto the Midas gold vein, he'd have died broke. Eugene will be richer than you when his father dies. He's a wastrel and a sot. He'll spend his fortune so fast your head will swim. I can handle him, said his sister. He's madly in love with me and will do anything I tell him. You can do much, much better, grunted Cromwell. He picked up a speaking tube and spoke to the driver. Abner, turn left at the next street and stop at the Butler residence. Abner held up a hand to indicate he understood. He stopped the rolls in front of a huge mansion constructed of wood in the Victorian style of the day. Then he stepped from the car and rang the bell at the iron-gated front door. A maid answered, and he handed her Cromwell's calling card. The maid took it and closed the door. A few minutes later, the door reopened, and a tall, handsome man with sharply defined facial features came out and walked toward the car. He could have passed for a matinee idol on stage. Like Cromwell, he wore a woolen suit that was dark navy rather than black, a starched collar, and a tie with a white diamond pattern. He paused in the portico and sniffed the air, which was tinged with a light fog that rolled in from the bay. Abner opened the Rolls' rear door, pulled down a jump seat, and stood back. Butler got in and sat down. He turned to Cromwell's sister. Maggie, you look positively stunning. Good enough to eat. He left it there, seeing the fearsome, hostile look in Cromwell's eyes. He greeted Cromwell without offering his hand.
Jacob, good to see you.
You look fit, said Cromwell, as if he cared.
In the pink, I walk 5 miles a day.
Cromwell ignored him, picked up the speaking tube, and instructed Abner where to pick up Marion Morgan. He turned to his sister.
What saloon on the Barbary Coast do you wish for us to mingle with the foul-smelling rabble?
I heard that Spider Kelly's was quite scrubby.
The worst dive in the world, Cromwell said knowledgeably. But they have good bands and a large dance floor.
Do you think it's safe? Asked Margaret. Cromwell laughed.
Red Kelly hires a small army of husky bouncers to protect affluent clientele like us from harm or embarrassment.
Spider Kelly's it is, said Butler. I even took my mumsy and dad there one evening. They truly enjoyed watching the mix of unsavory people who frequent the place. We sat in the slummer's balcony to watch the low-life cavort.
The Rolls stopped in front of an apartment building on Russian Hill just off Hyde Street on Lombard, a fashionable but affordable district of the city. This area of Russian Hill contained the homes and meeting places where intellectuals, artists, architects, writers, and journalists engaged in lofty arguments and discussions, but mostly socialized and partied. Marion did not stand on protocol. She was waiting out front on the top step of her building. As the Rolls eased to the curb, she descended and then stopped as Abner opened the door for her. She was dressed in a short jacket over a blue blouse with a matching skirt that had a simple elegance about it. Her blonde hair was drawn back and twisted into a long braid with a bow at the back of her long neck. Cromwell stepped out and gallantly helped her into the back seat. The chauffeur pulled down the other jump seat in which Cromwell, in a courtly manner, seated himself.
Miss Marion Morgan, may I present Mr. Eugene Butler?
And you've met my sister Margaret, he said, using her proper name.
Miss Cromwell, a pleasure to see you again.
Marion's tone was gracious, but not exactly filled with warmth.
Likewise, Eugene, Marion acknowledged sweetly with familiarity.
You know each other? Asked Margaret in surprise.
Eugene, Mr. Butler, took me to dinner some time ago.
2 years, Butler said good-naturedly. I failed to impress her.
She spurned all my later invitations.
And advances, Marion added, smiling.
Ready for a hot night on the Barbary Coast? Asked Cromwell.
It will be a new experience for me, said Marion. I've never had the courage to go there.
Remember the old song, said Margaret. The miners came in 49, the whores in 51, and when they got together, they produced the native son.
Marion blushed and looked demurely at the carpet on the floor as the men laughed.
A few minutes later, Abner turned onto Pacific Street and drove through the heart of the Barbary Coast, named after the lair of the Barbary pirates of Morocco and Tunisia. Here was the home of gamblers, prostitutes, burglars, con men, drunks, derelicts, cutthroats, and murderers. It was all there. Debauchery and degradation, poverty and wealth, misery and death. The infamous coast boasted more than 300 saloons, wall to wall, within 6 city blocks, 50 of them on Pacific Street alone. It existed because of crooked politicians who were bribed by the saloon, gambling house, and brothel owners. The reputable citizens of the city complained publicly about the den of iniquity, but averted their eyes because they were secretly proud of the distinction that their fair city of San Francisco more than equaled Paris, which bore the enviable reputation as the wickedest city in the Western Hemisphere, as a carnival of vice and corruption. And yet the Barbary Coast was glitzy and glamorous, with loads of ballyhoo and skullduggery, a veritable paradise for people of honest means to go slumming. The unsavory who ran the dens of sin, in most cases men, relished seeing the swells from Nob Hill enter their establishments because they had no scruples charging them exorbitant prices for admission and liquor, usually $30 for a bottle of champagne rather than the going rate of 6 to 8. Mixed drinks in most saloons were 25 cents, and beer a dime. Abner slipped the rolls through the revelers wandering the street and pulled to a stop in front of a 3-story building that served as a hotel upstairs. In reality, a brothel called a cow yard, which housed 50 women in rooms called cribs. The main floor was for gambling and drinking, while the downstairs basement had a stage for bawdy shows and a large wooden floor for dancing. They stepped from the car, with the men in the lead to shield the ladies, who stared with fascination at a flashy, uniformed barker on the sidewalk. "Step right into Spider Kelly's, the finest drinking and dancing establishment on the coast. All are welcome. All will have the night of their lives. See the wildest show and the most beautiful girls to be found anywhere. See them kick their heels over their heads. See them sway in a manner that will shock and amaze you."
"I like this place already," said Margaret gaily.
Marion stared and clutched Cromwell's arm tightly and looked up at a sign largely ignored by the clientele, that read, "No vulgarity allowed in this establishment." They entered a large U-shaped entrance lobby decorated with framed panels of nude women dancing amid Roman ruins. A manager decked out in an ill-fitting tuxedo greeted them and escorted them inside. "Do you wish to go downstairs for the show?" he asked. "The next one starts in 10 minutes. "We would like a safe table away from the riffraff," said Cromwell in a demanding tone. "After we've enjoyed a bottle of your finest champagne, we'll go downstairs for dancing and the show." The manager bowed. "Yes, sir. Right this way." He escorted Cromwell's party through the crowded saloon up to a table on the slummer's balcony Butler had mentioned overlooking the main floor of the saloon. Soon a waitress wearing a thin blouse cut low across her breasts and a skirt that came well above her knees, showing an ample display of legs in black silk stockings held up by capricious garters, brought a magnum of Veuve Clicquot Ponsardin champagne, vintage 1892. As she eased the bottle into an ordinary bucket filled with ice, she brushed against the men and gave each an earthy smile.
Margaret returned the smile, letting the waitress know that Margaret knew that besides serving customers in the saloon, she also worked in the cribs upstairs. Surprised at seeing a Nob Hill swell dressed in a revealing outfit, the waitress gave Margaret a lewd look.
"You know, dearie, a redhead like you is in high demand. You could name your own price."
Marion was stunned. Cromwell fought to keep from laughing, while Butler became outright indignant. "This is a lady," he snapped. "You will apologize." The waitress ignored him.
"If she's Jewish, she can make the top of the scale."
Then she turned, gave a wiggle to her buttocks, and walked down the stairway.
"What does being Jewish have to do with it?" Marion asked naively.
"There is a myth going around," explained Cromwell, "that Jewish redheads are the most passionate of all women."
Margaret was enjoying herself as she gazed around the main floor of the saloon. She felt a giddy elation at seeing the sailors and dock workers, the young and honest working girls who unknowingly were easily led astray, and the hardened criminals milling around the floor, which was littered with a small army of men too drunk to stand. Unknown to the others, including her brother, Margaret had visited the dives of the Barbary Coast on several occasions. And she was well aware that her brother Jacob often frequented the expensive and most exclusive parlor houses, where the royalty of the shady women plied their trade. Marion found it disgusting and fascinating at the same time. She had heard the coast was the pit of bitterness and despair for the poor of San Francisco, but she had no idea how far humans could sink. She was not used to drinking, and the champagne mellowed her after a while, and she began to see the depravity in a less sickening light. She tried to imagine herself as one of those loose women, taking men to the cribs upstairs for as little as 50 cents. Horrified at herself, she quickly pushed the thought from her mind and rose unsteadily to her feet after Cromwell held up the empty bottle and announced that it was time for them to go downstairs. The manager appeared and found a table that was occupied on the dance floor not far from the stage. Two couples dressed in soiled working clothes protested at having to give up their table, but the manager threatened them with bodily harm if they didn't move.
"What luck," said Margaret. "The show is just starting."
Cromwell ordered another magnum of champagne as they watched a well-endowed woman step onto the small stage and begin a dance of the seven veils. It wasn't long before the veils dropped away and she was left with a scanty costume that left little to the imagination. Her abdominal muscles rippled as she gyrated and made several lusty contortions. When she was finished, the men in the audience threw coins on the stage.
"Well, that was certainly arousing," Margaret said sarcastically.
A small band began playing, and couples moved onto the dance floor, stepping lively to a dance called the Texas Tommy. Butler and Margaret swirled around the floor with gay abandon as if they were one. Marion felt a self-conscious sense of embarrassment at being held close to her boss. In all the years she had worked for him, this was the first time he had ever asked her out. He was an excellent dancer, and she followed his lead gracefully. The band changed tempo at different times so the dancers could move to the steps of the turkey trot and the bunny hug. Soon the dancers began to sweat in the confined, airless quarters of the basement. The champagne began to make Marion's head reel, and she asked Cromwell if she could sit down for a few minutes.
"Would you mind if I left you for a little while?" Cromwell asked courteously. "I'd like to go upstairs and play a few hands of Pharaoh."
Marion was vastly relieved. She was on the verge of exhaustion, and her new shoes were causing discomfort to her feet.
"Yes, please do, Mr. Cromwell. I could stand a breather."
Cromwell climbed the wooden stairway and walked slowly through the bustling gambling section until he came to a table where there were no players except the dealer. Two burly men stood behind the dealer and discouraged any customer from sitting at the table. The dealer looked like he was born from a bull. His head sat like a chiseled rock on top of a neck that was as thick as a tree stump. His black hair was dyed, plastered down with pomade, and parted in the middle. His nose was flattened across his cheeks from being broken numerous times. His limpid eyes looked oddly out of place on a face that had seen more than its share of fists. He had the torso of a beer keg, round and abundant, but hard, without fat. Spider Red Kelly had been a fighter and had once fought James J. Corbett, knocking down the former heavyweight champion twice, but getting knocked out himself in the 21st round. He looked up at Cromwell's approach.
"Good evening, Mr. Cromwell. I've been expecting you."
Cromwell opened the cover to his watch and glimpsed the hands on the dial.
"Forgive me for being 8 minutes late, Mr. Kelly. I was unavoidably detained."
Red Kelly smiled, showing a mouthful of gold teeth.
"Yes, I would have also been detained if I was in the company of such a lovely lady."
He nodded at the table.
"Would you care to try your luck?"
Cromwell took out his wallet and counted out 10 $50 national bank notes printed by his bank under contract with the federal government. Kelly casually placed the bills in a small stack on the side of the table and pushed a stack of copper tokens advertising the saloon across the table. A typical faro layout of a suit of 13 cards was painted on the table's green felt cover. The suit was in spades from ace to king, with the ace on the dealer's left. Cromwell placed a token on the jack and one between the 5 and 6 in a bet called splitting. Kelly discarded the top card from the dealer box, displaying the next card, called the losing card. It was a 10. If Cromwell had bet on it, he would have lost, since the house wins any wagers placed on the displayed card. Then Kelly pulled the losing card out of the box, revealing the winning card. It was a 5. Cromwell won the full bet, not half. "Beginner's luck," he said as Kelly pushed the winning tokens across the table.
"What is your pleasure, Mr. Cromwell?"
"Nothing, thank you."
"You asked to see me," said Kelly. "What can I do to return the favors you've given me over the years, the generous loans and the help in keeping the police out of my place?"
"I need someone eliminated." Cromwell spoke as if he was ordering a beer.
"Here in the city?"
asked Kelly as he dealt another hand.
"No.
Denver."
"A man, I hope," said Kelly, without looking up from the dealer box. "Place your bet."
Cromwell nodded and moved a token between the Queen and Jack.
"Actually, he's an agent with the Van Dorn Detective Agency."
Kelly paused before pulling a card from the box.
"Taking out a Van Dorn agent could have serious repercussions."
"Not if it's done right."
"What's his name?"
"Isaac Bell." Cromwell passed across the picture his sister had given him. "Here's his photo." Kelly stared at it briefly.
"Why do you want him removed?"
"I have my reasons." Kelly pulled the losing card and revealed the winning card as the Queen. Cromwell had won again. Kelly gazed across the table at Cromwell.
"From what I've heard, everyone who's killed a Van Dorn agent has been tracked down and hung."
"They were criminals who stupidly allowed themselves to be run down by detectives from the agency. If done in an efficient manner, Van Dorn will never know who killed Bell or why. Make it look like a random killing or even an accident. Leaving no trace would make it impossible for Van Dorn's agents to retaliate." Kelly sank slowly back in his chair.
I have to tell you, Cromwell, I don't like it.
There was no Mr. Cromwell. Cromwell smiled a grim smile.
Would you like it if I paid you $20,000 for the job?
Kelly sat up and looked at Cromwell as if he was not sure if he believed him.
$20,000, you say?
I want it done by a professional, not some two-bit killer off the street.
Where do you wish the deed to take place?
There was never doubt that Kelly would do the job. The saloon owner was knee-deep in any number of criminal activities. Coming under Cromwell's spell for financial gain was a foregone conclusion. In Denver. Bell works out of the Van Dorn office in Denver.
The farther away from San Francisco, the better, Kelly said quietly. You got yourself a deal, Mr. Cromwell.
The mister was back, and the transaction agreed upon. Cromwell rose from his chair and nodded toward the tokens on the table. For the dealer, he said, grinning. I'll have $10,000 in cash delivered to you by noon tomorrow. You'll get the rest when Bell is deceased. Kelly remained seated.
I understand.
He pushed his way downstairs and through the dancers who had stopped dancing. He saw they were watching his sister perform an undulating and provocative hoochie-coochie dance on the stage to the delight of everyone present. She had loosened her corset and let her nicely coiffed hair down. Her hips swiveled and pulsed sensually to the music of the band. At the table, Butler was sprawled in a drunken haze while Marion stared in awe at Margaret's gyrations. Cromwell motioned for one of the managers, who also acted as bouncers.
Sir, please carry the gentleman to my car.
The bouncer nodded and, with one practiced motion, lifted the thoroughly intoxicated butler to a standing position and threw him over his shoulder. Then the bouncer proceeded up the stairs, carrying Butler's bulk as lightly as if he were a bag of oats. Cromwell leaned over Marion.
Can you walk to the car?
She glanced up at him as if angry.
Of course I can walk.
Then it's time to leave.
He took her by the arm and eased her from the chair. Marion, unassisted but wobbly, went up the stairs. Then Cromwell turned his attention to his sister. He was not amused by her scandalous behavior. He grabbed her by the arm hard enough to cause a bruise and hauled her off the stage and out of the saloon to the waiting car at the curb. Butler was passed out in the front seat with Abner, while Marion sat glassy-eyed in the back. Cromwell roughly shoved Margaret into the back seat and followed her, pushing her into one corner. He sat in the middle between the two women as Abner got behind the wheel, started the car, and drove up the street that was ablaze with multicolored lights. Slowly, Cromwell slid his arm around Marion's shoulders. She looked at him with a vague, unresponsive expression. The champagne had given her a sense of lethargy, but she was not drunk. Her mind was still clear and sharp. His hand squeezed one shoulder, and there was a small pause in her breathing. She could feel his body pressing against hers in the narrow confines of the seat. There was a time when Marion had found her boss appealing and felt a deep attraction to him. But in the years she had worked for him, he had made no effort to bridge the gap between them. Now, suddenly, after all this time, he was showing an interest in her. Strangely, there was no emotion or arousal surging within her. She felt as if she were repelled by him, and she couldn't understand why. Marion was relieved there were no further moves on his part. The one arm remained snaked around her waist, and his hand rested lightly on her shoulder until Abner stopped the rolls in front of her apartment house. Cromwell stepped to the sidewalk and helped her from the car. "Good night, Marion," he said, holding her hand.
I trust you had an interesting evening. It was as if she saw now something deep within him that she had never seen before, and she felt repulsed by his touch. It will be an evening I'll long remember, she said honestly. I hope Mr. Butler and your sister recover.
They'll be hung over tomorrow, and justly so, he said with a tight smile. I'll see you Monday morning. There is a pile of correspondence I have to dictate. I want to have a clean desk when I leave on a business trip on Friday.
You're leaving again so soon?
A banker's conference in Denver. I must attend.
Until Monday morning, then, she said with vast relief as he released her hand.
Marion climbed the steps to the door but turned and gazed at the Rolls-Royce as it pulled away into the street. Her mind acted without command. Things between her employer and herself would never be the same. There was a coldness about him that she was not aware of before, and she cringed as she remembered his touch. All of a sudden, the lingering smell of the dance hall's smoke and sweat on her clothes sickened her. She rushed upstairs to her room, turned on the faucets of her bathtub, frantically removed her clothes, and slipped into the soapy water to remove all memory of the decadent evening.
"What was your little meeting with Red Kelly all about?"
asked Margaret after they let off Marion at her apartment. "I hired him for a little job." She stared at his face as it was reflected by the light of the passing street lamps.
"What kind of a job?"
"He's going to take care of Isaac Bell," he said matter-of-factly.
"You can't murder a Van Dorn agent," Margaret gasped. "Every peace officer in the country would come after you."
Cromwell laughed. "Not to worry, dear sister. I instructed Kelly to administer only enough damage to keep Bell in the hospital for a few months. That's all. Call it a warning." Cromwell had blatantly lied to his sister. He would act surprised when Bell's murder was announced and claim the agent's death had been a mistake, that Kelly had gotten carried away. Inciting his sister's anger, he decided, was a small price to pay for eradicating the man who had become his worst enemy.